This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Presidential candidates remain thick on the ground in New Hampshire. Donald Trump is here today. Hillary Clinton was here Monday. She brought along Elizabeth Warren, who had plenty of barbs for Trump, but also some for Kelly Ayotte.
Donald Trump's not doing so well, and Kelly is running as fast as she can away from him.
But no matter how fast one runs, you can't get away from the nasty ads.
A former Exeter teacher committed sexual misconduct. The union leader said Maggie Hassan's husband covered it up.
Or from the polls, and of course, the debates.
Wow. Well, you didn't get six bills signed, but we'll leave that aside. The reality is
it's going to be like that for just over another week. We'll talk about it, the hacking at Dyne and Obamacare numbers. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in The Exchange. Give us a call. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. And we're at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Our guests are Kevin Landrigan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Casey McDermott from right here at NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, T-minus 10 days. Donald Trump is here today. Hillary was here Monday. We have a sort of team Democrats versus kind of a cheese stands alone dynamic on the Republican side. Is driving people to the polls, kind of getting the herd on its feet, easier to do with everybody working together, Dean?
Yeah, absolutely. The more integrated, vertically in terms of top of the ticket on down to local races, your organization is, the better you're going to be at driving out people to the polls. And we've known for some time that Hillary Clinton has a significantly larger operation in New Hampshire than Donald Trump, who has relied largely on the RNC to build his organization around the country. And, you know, when you get to this point in the cycle, I think there's a little bit of voter fatigue setting in. I hear it in friends and acquaintances and people I talk to out around the state, a bit of a saturation point, and it's not clear at this point, you know, who's really undecided and whether anybody can be persuaded. So the focus now is going to be on competitive turnout. And, you know, to the extent that we're seeing kind of more unity among Democrats, you see these large rallies where, you know, you have Clinton and then you have Governor Hassan and Colin Van Ostern, you know, sort of on down the ticket. Carol Shea Porter was at the St. A's rally the other day. That's all good in terms of turnout. The Republicans, as you said, the cheese stands alone. That's a new one for me. But that is a good metaphor for it. Much harder to turn out voters consistently around the state. And I think that could be problematic on election day.
I mean, in this more modern age of campaigning, sometimes these rallies are kind of the part of the iceberg, you may be able to see. But, you know, Kevin, do you recall an election like this before? I mean, I don't know how many Republican rallies we've been at over the years where it's one candidate after the next getting up there saying, you know, we're running against a tacky ticket of taxers, to borrow a phrase Judd Gregg used to deploy. But it has been a while since any of that went off like clockwork. But this year does seem to be kind of a different animal. So two questions, I guess, is Donald Trump essentially fracked open the fissures in the Republican Party at this point? And, you know, as he goes, will the GOP go next week?
Yeah, both really good questions, Josh. I think the Trump campaign has created this chasm, fissure, whatever you want to call it, in the Republican Party. There's at least two Republican parties now, and I think there's going to be not just a lot of soul searching, but quite a bit of leg breaking that's going to occur after this campaign, particularly as it goes, if it goes as it looks like it's going to go, and Hillary Clinton is elected president. I'm however not at all convinced that as Trump goes, the rest of the ticket goes. I do think this is a unique election. I do think there are a lot of Republicans who've made personal judgments about Donald Trump, but are still loyal Republicans and will still vote for the rest of the ticket. I also think in New Hampshire, we have a lot of independent voters who who become very uncomfortable when they get in the polling place. They close the curtain, and they vote for Hillary Clinton, and then they vote for Colin Van Ostrand, and then they vote for Maggie Hassan, and then they vote for Annie Custer, and they say, "Wait a minute, I'm not a Democrat. There's got to be, you know, there are good Republicans on the other side as candidates, and I'm going to vote for one or two of them." So I think we're going to see that.
And if you just look at the polling data, if the polling data is accurate and the race for Senate is as close as it appears to be, Kelly Ayotte is running significantly ahead of Donald Trump in the state. Just spend a little time walking around Concord. You'll see yard signs where there'll be an Ayotte sign, and right next to the Ayotte sign is a Clinton sign. Yeah. So I think that's her best hope, is that there is this separation, that we see an uptick in ticket splitting, which we haven't seen in a while, and that may be the case this time around.
I mean, one thing with the ticket splitting that is interesting is that, you know, Ayotte has been at arm's length, and, you know, Democrats would argue that she's kind of pulling Trump back towards her a bit. Now, we can talk about that later. You know, she's obviously said she's not voting for him. She wanted Frank Inna to resign. Look at Congressional District Number 2, and, you know, Jim Lawrence, you know, has problems there. His campaign has gotten little attention. What he has gotten hasn't been very good, has it, Casey?
No, it hasn't. And I think there was a new wrinkle in that this week with some allegations that he was behind on his child support payments. And before that, there were some questions about whether he paid his taxes, whether his business did the work that he said it did. So it's been kind of a steady stream of negative headlines for him over the last few weeks. So I don't know, I can't predict kind of how that's going to shake out. I think that if you asked around, people would say that Custer is probably pretty safe right now, just given her status as an incumbent. And she hasn't really done a lot to upset people broadly, I think, in the district. I think it's going to be interesting. And one other thing that I think has been interesting over the last few weeks, particularly as Ayotte has even been more forceful in distancing herself from Trump, is you've started to see some kind of messaging pop up around outside groups pushing Ayotte as a potential check on a potential President Clinton. So that's also something where they're trying to, again, kind of boost her stakes in the event that Clinton would still take
the U.S.
top
Chamber
of the ticket.
Commerce is running ads to that effect. I mean, meanwhile, the state GOP has a flyer out saying, you know, Donald Trump needs senators like Kelly Ayotte. You know, obviously this close to the tail end of an election, coherence, particularly in this age of, kind of decoupled campaign messaging, is not necessarily easy to come by. You know, another race that's operated pretty below the radar, although, you know, when you get them on the debate stage, it may induce flashbacks, is the first congressional district, and, you know, Frank Inta and Carol Shea Porter. And, you know, why don't we take a listen to them from the NH1 debate?
Wow. Well, you didn't get six bills signed, but we'll leave that aside. The reality is that you said that you were going to put in a bill for term limits. And if you believe that, and good for you, you should put in a bill for term limits. But you really have been involved. You can't have it both ways. You keep talking about being a public servant. You've done two terms. I've done three terms. So it's pretty close. But you've been around since 2006 running for every office.
Not for the
seat.
And
you say, well, you were aspiring for it. And you say it's because of public service. And good for you. I mean, public service is a wonderful thing.
Well, I think that one.
I'm going to give Sean O'Connor
sure,
the final
yeah,
word.
Sure.
Okay,
I think
Mr.
that
O'Connor.
I think the one thing I can agree with Congressman Gintz on is that the people want an outsider. They're tired of this debate. Think that it's a good thing that they've been in politics since 2006.
All right, that was two very familiar voices to New Hampshire voters, Carol Shea Porter and Frank Ginta. Ginta is currently the incumbent. You know, the less familiar voice are Sean O'Connor, who's in this race as an independent. We've talked about him somewhat before. Democrats wanted to keep him off the ballot. He was originally planning to run as a Democrat. They didn't. He made it to 10% in the most recent WMUR UNH poll. So he's gotten into the debate, and he'll be on the debate on MUR next week, the one that gets the most viewership. And he seems to be making some headway, at least with editorial boards, doesn't he, Kevin?
Yeah, he really does. If you remember, he ran as a Democrat in the primary, had a very bitter falling out with the Shea Porter campaign, accused them of spreading lies about him, and caused him to drop out of that race and run as an independent in this general election. he is changing the dynamic. If those polls are accurate, then it's very good news for Frank Ginter. Ginter could conceivably win this race. This is the fourth rematch between him and Carol Shea Porter, and he's certainly the weakest position politically he's been in since he started, given, you know, the FEC problems that he had had since the last election, entering into that settlement. But the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee reserved $2.7 million in advertising time, assuming they were going to have to help carry Carol Shea Porter over the finish line. Now, Ginter barely won his Republican primary, as we saw, and the Democrats canceled plans to run those ads for Shea Porter. They may regret that. I mean,
the Republicans have canceled the ads that they were planning to run to sort of rebut the ads. And, you know, they said, well, you know, if the Democrats move their money, we don't need to spend our money. And they have to make, you know, kind of hard-headed decisions at this time of year. But, you know, one thing that's interesting about O'Connor is that he was originally pitching himself as this, you know, Bernie Sanders guy.
Progressive.
And now, you know, I'm going to caucus with the majority. And, you know, he picked up the editorial endorsement of the Portsmouth Herald. And, you know, newspaper endorsements aren't worth what they once were. There's a positive column about him in the Conway Sun. When he visited the union leader, your paper, he went over reasonably well. Yep. I mean, according to Trent Spinner, he blew his socks off. And so, you know, it's an interesting wrinkle, but I mean, it begs the question of, like, you know, who's he pulling votes from? You know, he would say both. Ginter obviously was probably, you know, next to Sean O'Connor, the most excited when he managed to get in the race. The logic had been Shea Porter, Dean.
Yeah,
open question.
It's an interesting complication, and you saw Frank Ginter at the beginning of the NH1 debate talk about how important it was that Sean O'Connor be included in the process, and then he proceeded to kind of paint him as this kind of liberal left wing Bernie Sanders acolyte. If O'Connor is successful in kind of coming across as kind of a more independent, maybe, you know, in some ways centrist kind of politician, you know, maybe he could pick up some independent voters from Frank Ginter. But the initial concern is certainly for Carol Shea Porter and whether or not he's going to cut into her support. I mean, the most recent polls we've seen have her up double digits. I don't recall if that includes Sean Connor or not. If it does, then that's pretty good news for her. If it doesn't, then we have to wait and see. But, you know, we've been saying for months now that, you know, Frank Ginter is sort of hanging in there. He's very tenacious. People have written him off. This could end up being a close, a close race if O'Connor picks off some votes from Shea Porter. You know, on the other hand, Shea Porter has done quite well in presidential years in terms of Democratic margin. So all other things being equal, if O'Connor starts to pick from, you know, both candidates, then, you know, maybe that will be in her favor.
I mean, we spoke with Shea Porter yesterday on the exchange, and, you know, she was pretty frank about the fact that in presidential years, you know, she does better. I mean, the results speak for themselves, and in non-presidential years, she doesn't. She likes her chances this year, and, you know, she remains kind of as blunt as ever. I mean, on some issues, it's sort of hard to tease out exactly what she means. But on others, you know, you ask her a straight up question: would you support a carbon tax to deal with climate change? And she says yes, she would. You know, would you do you believe there should be, you know, tighter gun control? Like, yes, I do. And you know, there are a lot of voters, you know, who respond positively to her approach. And, you know, I guess we'll see. But, you know, Sean O'Connor is proving to be, you know, doing a little bit more than, I guess, like I would have assumed, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned the endorsement that he picked up from the Portsmouth paper. And I think that, you know, this is as glowing an endorsement as you could really ask. It's, you know, touting his status in their eyes as a moderate, which the paper says is a good match for the congressional district, given that it's kind of bopped back and forth between the Democrat and the Republican over the last few years. They seem to be enamored with his pledge to take only minimum wage for his work as a congressman and donate the rest to charity. They cite a number of his policy positions. So I think that, you know, for someone who, as you said, kind of came out of nowhere this cycle and had a little bit of a rocky start with the party establishment that he hoped to start out with, that he's doing a lot better than people expected him to.
And certainly, you know, anybody who walks in the door might benefit by the comparison to Ginton Shea Porter, who, you know, I think it's fair to say, you know, can come across as a bit shopworn at this point. So, you know, we'll see if there's a real campaign, though, that he's running or whether it's...
There's an office in downtown Manchester that I walked past last night. So there's at least kind of the, infrastructure there. Yeah.
He's got, isn't it double the number of Facebook likes that... Carol Shea Porter and Congressman Ginta have put together. He comes from the .com world. He's very savvy computer wise, and he's used that well. But it is important to point out, as you said earlier, Carol Shea Porter is the front runner in this race and has to still do a lot of things wrong, and Sean O'Connor has to really outperform to deny Shea Porter this win on November 8th.
I mean, this is a rare race, though, where lack of familiarity may, you know, augur to one's benefit. Yep. And to the extent that, you know, voters see, you know, Ginta and Shea Porter back up on the debate stage, I mean, you know, I've interviewed both of them. I've seen them campaigning a little bit. But once you get the visual of there they are again, you know, who knows what that summons in voters internally.
Well, it may just simply mean that they pay less attention. It's like, oh, here we go again. And O'Connor may not even get to the point of having additional visibility. You know, part of the problem is it's a presidential election year, and you've got the governor's race and the Senate race. These congressional races really are kind of at the bottom of the sort of the major offices in the state in terms of visibility. It's just the reality of a crowded election year. And then you mix in that this is their fourth time, and I think just a lot of people are not even paying attention. And so, you know, it's O'Connor's goal is to kind of sort of get into the conversation and maybe present himself as a fresh alternative. If he can do that, you know, he might have some success.
What do you think? Give us a call. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or, of course, on Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange. On both sites. And so, you know, let's talk a little bit about where we stand, you know, roughly over a week out. You know, polls have been all over the place. Historically, a lot of people have paid attention to the polls out of UNH at this time of year. You know, they show Democrats up pretty much everywhere from, you know, the widest gap being at the top of the ticket with Clinton over Trump by 15, you know, Hassan up 8 over Ayotte, Van Ostrand up 4, and Sununu on the congressional races and on a generic statehouse ballot. You know, some have said this poll is perhaps an outlier. I spoke with Andy Smith about this yesterday. He said that, you know, he's been getting some guff for not waiting for party ID. He said to do so would be unwise. You know, do you think it's tighter than that, Dean?
I do to some extent. You know, it's a remarkable kind of how all over the map the polling is. Certainly, the UNH polls are the most favorable scenario for the, you know, Democrats. Is Clinton up by 15 in New Hampshire? Maybe, probably not. It's probably more sort of 6-8. Maybe I've seen some polls at 9%. But it's certainly, you know, even if you kind of look at the averages, it still looks pretty good for Democrats, the one exception being the Senate race, which just seems to be incredibly tight, depending on which. I've seen polls with Clinton slightly up and polls with Ayotte up by a point or two. And, you know, I think there's always a danger at this point in the cycle for people to read 1 or 2 percentage point differences between polls as substantive change in the race. A lot of it could just be, at this point, statistical noise or a function of the sampling or the turnout model. And I think people sort of really kind of ride on 1 or 2% changes. And that's not always the best thing to do. It's better to look at the averages. So I certainly think that UNH has them going in the right direction. You know, is it that large? Maybe not.
Once again, this is the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook or Twitter. More politics. We'll head directly into that high-stakes U.S. Senate race after the break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477 or email at exchange@nhpr.org. This week we're joined by Kevin Landergan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Casey McDermott, NHPR, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. You join us as well. I want to turn to the Senate race. Obviously, that's been getting a lot of attention for a very long time. It's hard to keep track of the amount of money that's being spent. And some of that money went into an ad that started running this week that's generating a bit of controversy. Why don't we take a listen?
A former Exeter teacher committed sexual misconduct. The union leader said Maggie Hassan's husband covered it up. But Hassan took campaign cash from the sexual predator and put him on her steering committee.
Well, I sensed something was wrong because of the teacher's abrupt departure from the school. I didn't know, and I didn't have information that I could pass on.
All right, that ad began running this week. It's by Pro AOT Super PAC, Granite State Solutions. It's being operated by a guy named Brooks Kochvar, who managed her first U.S. Senate campaign. And that ad has been stirring a bit of controversy because it's an ad that goes after her directly for something that her husband has alleged to have fallen short on, policing misconduct at Phillips Exeter. Kevin, can you recall an ad that went directly at someone who wasn't the candidate?
Yeah, this is pretty rough, but I think we did expect it. You know, this campaign started when there was talk of Maggie Hassan running for the Senate. These super PACs and organizations, and there was a lot of reporting that went on with regard to the Boston Globe did some newspapers, including the union leader. And others did some reporting about this in the past. So Hassan had to know this controversy would cycle back at the appropriate time, in quotes, the appropriate time being just before the election. So she has very little time to respond. I gave one of her strongest moments during the NH1 debate came in response to this ad on Thursday night when she said, "This is an appalling personal attack on my family. The facts are, as soon as my husband knew about this, he brought it to the police's attention. The facts also are that professor made contributions to your campaign for governor, Governor Hassan, and the facts also are that he was put on the steering committee in Rockingham County for your campaign. Now, the contributions were returned. He was taken off the steering committee. But there seemed to have been some relationship there. But I thought what was interesting was Senator Ayotte's response.
Why don't we listen? I think we've got that queued up. Why don't we play that?
You know, I've been attacked on my character. I have been attacked with misleading ads about my record, and Governor Hassan has not said anything about it. We could have kept this money out, and so she'll have to address this ad.
All right, that was Kelly Ayotte last night when asked about this ad that was from a super PAC supporting her, not something she would legally have any control over. And, I know some, mostly Democrats, you can see them on social media, aghast that Senator Ayotte would not disavow this ad. And, that's their prerogative. It was interesting to hear what Senator Ayotte said. I mean, she tried to turn this back towards, what is now a rather well-trod argument about, the first thing they fought about in this race, really, which was whether to agree to a so-called people's pledge to limit outside spending and the sort that they had in Massachusetts. And Casey, remind people of how what happened when why they failed to agree.
There were different terms, and they're escaping me now, but it would have placed limits on the number of outside contributions, the amount of outside contributions that could have been spent on the race. This is something that's been used, I believe, in previous races.
It was used in Massachusetts,
yeah.
And it was proposed, and when Scott Brown challenged Gene Shaheen, this had been in place in his race against Elizabeth Warren, and then it had been proposed, and sort of like this year, the challenger, if you're needing to raise money, you don't mind outside money. It's going to help you out because you're going to have a harder time raising it than the incumbent. Governor Hassan, when Senator Ayotte proposed this so-called People's Pledge, she, proposed something a little more stringent and said we would just have a cap on overall spending.
Cap, yeah.
And then, there was they never really agreed to anything, and it's hard to necessarily believe that either was entirely earnest in their desire to reach agreement.
Well, the other thing that's interesting, too, is that I think the cap on spending would have been no more than $15 million that each of them would have been allowed to spend. But according to campaign finance figures as recently as last month, neither of them was close to that threshold because there's been a lot of outside money in the race. And, you know, granted, this People's Pledge was perhaps designed to limit that outside money, but it's still, you know, without that in place, there's been kind of an opening of the floodgates. And we're now one of the most expensive races in the nation.
It's pretty amazing that, they haven't even reached the thresholds, and yet we're over, I think, $65 million on spending on this race.
Well over that.
95% of the money, according to a report this week, has come from outside New Hampshire
And the downside of all this outside money is we're seeing, in addition to sort of amping up the kind of negativity in the campaign, is the candidates really kind of lose control of the message and their ability to control messages they're sending to voters. And, you know, the issue with this particular ad with Maggie Hassman's husband is, you know, traditionally sort of good sportsmanship in campaigns is that you leave families out of it. But what they're suggesting here is in some way that she was either complicit or knew about this and didn't take action, and sort of guilt by association, she was involved in some sort of cover up, even though there's no real evidence of that. So it's just, you know, kind of the reality of the situation. I was recalling that when she ran for governor, I think it was maybe the second time, she was hit with an ad about failure to pay property taxes. Well, they lived in a house on that was owned by Exeter because he was the headmaster of Exeter. So, I mean, it's a sort of a different circumstance. So it's just sort of the reality of the situation. You know, the Supreme Court has said that this is all constitutionally protected free speech. My argument has always been that a lot of it is just kind of wasted money because people reach a saturation point, but it's there for better or worse.
The big donors never know if it's wasted, though. And that's the previous couple
cycles we've had where there's been this sort of geometrically increased spending. It hasn't been a sort of a one-for-one payoff for some of these candidates. We've had some big money that's basically been just sort of poured down the drain.
Well, one wrinkle about this that I found interesting was that at least $500,000 that went to the Grand State Solutions, a super PAC, was funneled in there by this guy, Jay Fazin, who is a tech guy with a lot of money from, I believe, North Carolina, who was supportive of Republicans who he said we're going to take action on climate change, Ayotte being one of the Republicans he decided to support. It's interesting that at least $500,000 of his money went into a fund that, you know, ended up producing this ad, for what it's worth, about, I guess, like the sort of fungibility of people's politics.
It's true, but I think Dean's on to something with regard to saturation. I mean, as Ayotte mentioned in her response, there have been 35 different attack ads against Kelly Ayotte. And not an equal number, but a large number in the dozens against Governor Maggie Hassan. I think that's one of the reasons why an ad such as this is not at the opportune time. The opportune time would have been to rough her up at the beginning of this campaign with this kind of attack ad. By the end, most voters are tuned out to all these attacks, and they're not moving the needle either way. This is a pick'em column coin toss race, and it's going to remain that way right up till November 8th.
Well, I mean, to that point, do you think that makes the debate performances potentially more important? And that, you know, I can't imagine there are that many people who, you know, aren't leaning one way or the other if they've been paying any attention. But, I mean, might there be a moment in a debate that would potentially tip somebody?
Well, I think we saw that with the NECN debate, at least in terms of the publicity that it generated whenever Ayotte was asked about her stance on whether or not Donald Trump was a role model. And that became kind of a talking point and driving headlines, not only in New Hampshire, but nationally for the next few days. And I think that she's been able to kind of shake that off a little bit just in her own distancing of herself from Trump since then. But I think that's an example of a case where, you know, people have these kind of baked in ideas of what these candidates are and who they represent and what values they represent. And that was a moment where I think you potentially could have had some of those voters who were down the middle, who we were talking about before, maybe be like, oh, well, you know, I don't know about that if she's not willing to take a harder line stance, which she since has, of course.
Well, as far as Ayotte and Trump, I mean, it is interesting that she needs some of those voters in order to win, and how to reach out to them. I mean, she has been, you know, there is less kind of what I would call public campaigning, you know, across the board in these races. But you look at Kelly Ayotte's Twitter feed, and, you know, there's lots of kind of campaigning where, you know, you might think Trump voters would be. You know, she's dropping into a Walmart, she's, you know, behind the meat counter at Market Basket. You know, do you think that's a way to you know, get to people, Kevin?
No, absolutely do. And you've seen some of her ads in the last couple of weeks, and they were regular voters, working class people, nurses, people working in factories, talking about Ayotte. This is a fascinating issue that I don't think we can't know until November 8th. But if there's 5% of diehard Trump people who say, I'm not voting for Ayotte because of what she did to him, then Ayotte loses this election. And so the people who say there was no risk for Ayotte to do what she did are totally misguided. It was very risky for her to do that, and that's precisely why 95% of Republicans across the country have been frozen about Trump for months, because they don't know the impact if they cross him.
All right. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477 or email at exchange@nhpr. Are you frozen by Trump, and are you on the fence in this big U.S. Senate race? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I mean, in watching the debate on NH1 last night between Ayotte and Hassan, you could see that both of them are pretty, you know, kind of well-oiled at this point, as they might be, with where they stand. I mean, there was a lot of talk about, you know, who is more dependent on talking points. I thought it was interesting when Kelly Ayotte described Hassan as being selected by Washington insiders, which, you know, there might be a kernel of truth. You know, we heard the same critique of her from Ovid LaMontagne back in 2010. I guess it depends on where you stand. There is a belief that Washington insiders aren't likable. However, did you see anything in the debate last night, Dean, that you know, stood out?
No, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I watched it as well, and I think this is their fifth debate or something like that, and I was looking for something, anything that sort of got my attention, given how many times I've heard them take a lot of these positions, and it really was sort of a fairly traditional debate in which, you know, each candidate strives to demonstrate how independent they are, and, you know, they all talked about times in which they would sort of buck their party's stance, and certainly Maggie Hassan tried to show that she was independent from Hillary Clinton to some extent and President Obama. So you present yourself as kind of a reasonable, independent individual willing to work across party lines, and you paint your opponent as kind of a tool of the National Party, or a puppet, if you will, of National Party elites. And so it's a fairly kind of predictable hour. And, you know, a lot of times people tune into these dates to confirm or reinforce their prior beliefs about the candidates, rather than sort of being up in the air or on the fence. A lot of it is just sort of saying, yeah, okay, I am going to vote for this person that I thought I would vote for.
Well, increasingly, like, people watch these debates on, you know, kind of multiple screens. They're watching it on television. They're watching it on
clips
social media.
Twitter,
and, you know, you watch Twitter or Facebook during this debate, and, you know, sometimes, you know, you have the campaign and their partisans sort of hyperventilating over one small moment or another. And, you know, it's hard to know what that's for. I mean,
it's tough to gauge how effective that really is. And this is a question I have just generally about kind of the partisan social media that goes on the NH politics feed, because a lot of it gets kind of crowded up by, like, you know, party staffers, campaign staffers, diehard partisans who've been with the parties for years, who are just kind of flooding it with their own talking points or their own, you know, occasionally the occasional kind of gif or meme that they've created around a particular moment. But it's also very much an echo chamber. So you have people like us who are following it, who are reporters or otherwise engaged politically, to a degree that the average New Hampshire voter probably isn't. So I think that it's important. I've had to remind myself quite frequently over the last few years to take a step back from Twitter, and that voters are not as plugged into those kinds of crossfires as we are.
This is interesting. This is one of the big debates that's been going on in political science for many years about whether or not campaigns even matter. There's a belief among political scientists that you look at these sort of larger structural determinants in the country, the economy and other sorts of measures, you can kind of predict where the election's going to go. But when you're in the trenches with these campaigns, there's a real belief in tactical warfare. That's why now with social media, you have most large campaigns have these rapid response teams where literally no word, no sentence, no anything goes unchecked without providing the opposite argument. And so you get on Twitter or whatever social media application you're on, and it is just this sort of constant back and forth that really does not advance the decision for most voters.
All right, well, why don't we engage in the social media of a more traditional sort, the telephone. Susan is on the phone from Concord. Welcome, Susan.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I'm interested in the skill set comparison between Senator Ayadi and Governor Hassan. And I'm very impressed with Governor Hassan's skill set and efficiency. Would you address the question of skill comparison, please?
Well, all right. You know, Kevin, you've seen them both in action. You know, obviously they have slightly different resumes.
They do, but both accomplished. Maggie Hassan, former Senate Majority Leader, very accomplished legislator who really got involved in politics because of her son, Ben, who has significant disabilities, and she was fighting for, as an advocate, the kind of famous story that then-Governor Jean Shaheen met her at a meeting at a task force about disabilities, kind of turned to an aide and said, who the heck is this woman? We got to get her in politics. And that's how she ended up in them. Kelly Ayotte, the first woman attorney general. She was a female legal counsel to the last Republican governor, Craig Benson. Certainly was seen as a formidable political figure herself in her first term in the U.S. Senate. Becomes on the short list of Mitt Romney's for running mate in 2012. Susan brings up a very good point. The skill set at this level is extremely good. I mean, these are two of the top five rising political stars among women in the country. And that's why a loss will be a tragedy for the party in one case and a great success in another. But we kind of interrupt this thoughtful debate for a patently sexist remark I'm going to make with regard to this debate, and that is if this were two men, they would have torn each other's eyes out by now. And it really speaks to the difference of women in politics that I've always been fascinated by and followed here because, as we know, in New Hampshire, women have risen to great heights. And seeing women such as Jean Shaheen on the left, Donna Sitek on the right, there's kind of like this mature chip that's get embedded in the brains of successful women in politics. And they really understand intuitively. My mother used to say, you never let your kids see you sweat. And women understand that in politics. Men can't help themselves. They jump over the table and start, like I said, grappling with their opponent. These two act mature. They act adult. They're very respectful to one another. They still have a relationship, even though the campaigns loathe themselves. And that's a skill set that's very unique in politics today.
I mean, they've also had to interact with each other for years, side by, I mean, literally sitting next to each other at a number of ribbon cuttings. Yep. I'm sure they've crossed paths at a 5K at one point. but they also, I mean, I was struck by the same thing, honestly, at our forum that we had earlier this week. They were very civil, and it stood in stark contrast to the kind of negative at each other's throats that you see online between the two sides. So.
Susan, thank you for your call. Keep with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We'll be back in a moment. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at NHPR. And I want to read an email we've received from Christopher from Manchester. And he asked the question, how do your guests see the New Hampshire State Senate going? Will a Democratic sweep at the top change the complexion of the Senate and House? And he says will. I would say would. How do you see things going down ballot? I mean, is that just basically going to be told by what happens at the presidential race, Kevin?
Well, I think, no. As colleagues here, Dan Barrick and others at NHPR, have done some good reporting on state Senate races. Many of those races, particularly at the state Senate level, I don't think it's state representative, but at state Senate level, a good local candidate can win a race and outperform the party. And there are some good local candidates.
There are a handful of districts.
And that's the part people don't get, is that there's 24 districts in the state Senate, 14 Republican, 10 Democratic, and really only 6 or 7 are competitive. The others have been gerrymandered to favor Democrats or favor Republicans, and those races are not in doubt. And so that brings you to, in the order of, 10 to 8 Republican, and then you fight over the last 6, and if Democrats can run the table or come close to it, they can actually take over.
All right. We're going to take a phone call now to shift gears out of politics for a moment to David Brooks, Concord Monitor, a.k.a. Granite Geek, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about what happened late last week that we didn't get to discuss on the roundup that happened at Dyne, as well as New Hampshire's sort of Luddite voting machines and why those may be good. David, good morning.
Good morning.
So, David, Dyne routes web traffic, under assault last week from hackers, ground things to a halt for a lot of websites. I guess my first question is real basic. How big a deal was that?
It was a very big deal. So it was a DDoS, distributed denial of service attack, which had been around for a long time, and everybody knows there are problems. So basically what those are is somebody gets control of a whole bunch of machines and tells them to send a lot of junk files all at once to one place and sort of overwhelms that place that gets them. So Dyne, as you said, it's what's called a DNS server. Basically, it runs the address book of the Internet is the way it's often described. And it itself was not hacked. Nobody got into the Dyne systems, but they were flooded Friday morning a couple of times for a couple hours at a time. And when Dyne was flooded, your computer and my computer couldn't use the address book to find where websites were, so we couldn't get to places like Twitter and Spotify and the Boston Globe. So it effectively knocked those sites off the Internet. As I said, it's not a surprise. In fact, Dyne had even one of its security folks had given a talk the day before about how to prepare for a DDoS attack. But what was surprising and what makes it a big deal was the scope and the size of the attack. Dyne is as ready as any business on the Internet to handle this stuff, and it was swamped, which just shows that the problem is bigger than we thought, and it's related to the Internet of Things.
All right, we don't have time to get too deep into the Internet of Things, but I do want to talk about another thing you wrote about this week that was certainly of interest and certainly relevant given the talk of elections security, and that is New Hampshire's deliberately dumb voting machines is how you call them, and you wrote about how maybe that's actually kind of smart.
Oh, it's absolutely smart, and it was a very deliberate choice. I believe Bill Gardner, Secretary of State, made the decision a while back, and I'm sure others supported him to not go down the online voting route. So we don't have touch screens and all that. We still have paper ballots, and most places they are actually counted by a machine that uses optical reading to count them. Smaller towns still do it by hand. And those machines are deliberately not networked. They go so far as to knock the pins out of them, so you can't even plug a network cable into them. For reporters like us, that's annoying because it takes it longer.
It makes it a late night.
Yeah, it makes it late night. You and I are screaming at it on deadline. But as voters and as citizens of New Hampshire, it's a good idea because it makes us more confident that nobody's gotten into these machines and messed around with them. And we always have the paper ballots to double check.
But so in your the bottom line, in your estimation, there's no way that somebody could externally hack these machines due to the fact that they are, the cords have been cut, more or less?
You get software updated for each election because it's got to know which people are going to be on the ballot, and those are put in with a physical chip that is sent to every, all the town clerks, and there's all these, you have to sign them off and all that kind of stuff. So it is not inconceivable that somehow something could be done to that chip. They do tests, but, sometimes you can go around. So it is possible, and there are a few people out there who still think that it's been hacked.
I do get those emails.
You get those emails. I get those emails. I've looked at them, and you and I reported on them in the past. I just don't think they're credible, partly because every time they've gone back to recount with the paper ballots, we've got the paper ballots, they've never found any serious discrepancy. So I'm extremely confident, and I'm very glad we do this and we don't have touchscreen voting machines.
Well, all right, David, thank you for joining us. That's David Brooks of Concord Monitor, Granite Geek, frequent guest on NHPR. Thanks, David.
Always glad to be here.
All right. So, you know, as we heard, you know, Bill Gardner and our elections officials made a, you know, conscious decision to avert this sort of thing. You know, Casey, you've talked to Bill Gardner recently a lot about voting, and this is a man who makes posters of wooden ballot boxes. So this is very much
I
of
have
a
seen
piece,
those
but...
posters quite a few times.
So, you know, Kevin, validation for Bill Gardner's old-fashioned ways?
Well, certainly, you know, in this day and age, if you can keep the system dumb, it's not hackable. And that's a real concern. The Homeland Security Department has said there have been 13 states where there have been threats of hacking into these electoral systems. It's one of the other reasons why... and we'll write about this in the Sunday News this weekend, why New Hampshire is now an outlier when it comes to early voting. I mean, there's now 37 states where you, and as many as a third of the votes in some states will be cast before Election Day. You can't do that here in New Hampshire unless you have a valid reason that your town clerk has approved. You can be issued an absentee ballot. But other than that, you have to show up on Election Day. And Bill Gardner says, that's why our turnout is so good. These states are cheapening the exercise of voting. And so as a result, voting turnout is actually going down in these states where they've tried to make it easier and easier to vote.
All right. We don't want to devalue the ritual of making our way to the polling place. I want to turn to an email we received. This is from Richard, who wants to chime in on last night's debate on NH1 between Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan. And he says, one thing that stood out to me was Kelly's criticism of Hassan's budget veto that held up important funding for the people of New Hampshire. What was this thing about two-thirds of the funding not getting spent? Kevin, what was that thing about the money not being spent? And was that a fair criticism?
Well, it's a fair criticism, and Hassan has a fair response to it. One thing she says is that the Republican-led legislature took 7 months to act on my proposals on the heroin epidemic, to fully act on the proposals. The other is that thanks to the system we have in New Hampshire, which is all state contracts have to be competitively bid, and we've talked about this before, all contracts have to be approved by the board of directors, namely the executive council. It's a lengthy process, and Hassan has said basically all the money has been slotted to be spent. But it's true that two-thirds of the last slug of money that went out, in other words, $2 million of the last $3 million of the money that went out, has not yet been spent. And that was the criticism Ayotte had made. And I thought, when we're talking about criticism of politics, I think it's an issue on which Republicans have not done a good job messaging at all. I mean, this, keep in mind, Maggie Hassan's only the second governor in the last 100 years who's vetoed a state budget in New Hampshire. And the last one, Josh will remember, the last one voters threw out of office after 2 years. A year after he vetoed that budget, Republican Governor Craig Benson, and
it was a similar. It was similar in you know, dissimilar in many respects. Yes. But similar in one respect, which was the budget that then, you know, came to pass was, you know, pretty similar to the one that had been vetoed.
Yeah, real similar. It did include money for a negotiated pay raise for state workers, which the Republican-led budget that she vetoed did not include, but in the main, it was very similar. She says it was more financially accountable. It put affordable conditions on the future business tax cuts that are going to occur next year, only if business tax revenues are appropriately high enough, and they have been, so those tax cuts.
But I mean, I think your point is interesting, though, that it was a risky thing to do.
Absolutely
at
risky
thing to do. At least history would have suggested it would have been risky, yeah. And it doesn't seem to be hurting her.
No, and many people thought when it happened, she's obviously not running for the U.S. Senate. You know, when she vetoed the budget, She's going to stay put. And, of course, she took another big risk running for this seat.
Yeah, and that veto has been the source of much of the Republican criticism of her record as governor. On the other hand, she can turn it around and say that, you know, she was sort of standing resolute against this sort of business tax proposal, which she believed had insufficient accountability in it. So, you know, I think it cuts both ways. But it is interesting how frequently when you look at Republican criticisms of her, you can eventually kind of trace it back to the budget and that particular veto as the kind of the genesis of the argument against her.
All right, let's go back to the audience. Walters and Warner. Good morning, Walter.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Go ahead.
I just have a question. We got Donald Trump, and I just wonder if because the Republicans had something like 16 candidates, wasn't that the cause of his win?
I'm not sure it was quite that simple, but, you know, a lot of candidates at the beginning of this process, I mean, Republicans said, look at how strong this field is. We have 16 people. This is going to generate excitement, and this is going to serve us well, weren't they, Dean?
Yeah, you know, it is a little bit more complicated than that. It was 16 or 17, I think, at its highest point. And, you know, I've seen various arguments and calculations about how if certain individuals had not run, supporters would have coalesced in such a way as to draw a bigger percentage than Donald Trump did in the New Hampshire primary. So, you know, I think some people are going to point to the size of the field. But, you know, it's also very clear that he tapped into something kind of very sort of almost primal in one part of the Republican electorate in terms of their kind of disaffection and unhappiness with the rebound from the Great Recession and the Obama administration more generally. And he was able to capitalize on that. So, you know, I think it's always going to be the case in these primaries that we have large fields, 6, 8, maybe 10, 17 was unusual. But, you know, he managed to get the greatest number of votes.
Thanks for the call, Walter. I want to move to one topic that is political but not explicitly electoral, which is the new Obamacare numbers that were released this week that showed that, you know, costs for plans across the country are rising nationwide 22%. Here in New Hampshire, the increase was a lot smaller, Casey. Why?
Well, we have a little bit more competition than what you're seeing in other places, so that helped to keep it down. And it was a lot smaller than a lot of other places. We're only slated to see a 2% increase on average. And keep in mind that could, you know, certain plans could
sort of
see
11 to 14
yeah,
overall.
Exactly. So based on, I'm looking at a report in the Concord Monitor from earlier this week, and this report says that a non-smoking 27-year-old buying the silver level of insurance, which is kind of like the middle of the road, will pay about $219 a month, which is the lowest of any state on healthcare.gov and less than kind of the average, which is around $300. That's still a lot out of pocket. I mean, as a 25-year-old, that would be a good chunk of my monthly budget. But, you know, keeping in mind that it could be a lot more if you're elsewhere, that's, you know, potentially good news. And when you saw this news come out earlier this week, I think you saw a bit of cheerleading among Republicans that, like, it's this gift that was dropped into their laps
Let's
in the final 2 weeks of the election. But the fact that it's not necessarily going to be as drastic in New Hampshire might lessen the extent to which it's a political liability for Democrats.
Well, and the Republicans have just not done a good job of weaponizing it at the presidential level. You had that clip of Donald Trump at his hotel opening the other day, or maybe it was at Doral at the club, saying that, you know, all of his employees have really suffered under Obamacare, and then it turns out that while 99% of them are covered by the company's insurance, and they pay something like 70. The company pays 70% of the premium. So it appeared as though he didn't really even understand kind of the notion of the national marketplace and what this particular aspect of Obamacare is all about. So it's kind of been a missed opportunity for them. Any other election year with a different Republican candidate, this would be a golden opportunity, and they just have not capitalized on it.
Well, it is interesting to hear Republicans. I mean, we've had the debate NHPR did with the New Hampshire Business Review and the BIA earlier this week, and Obamacare was something we spent a lot of time on. And, you know, Republicans, you know, Kelly Ayotte isn't saying we need to repeal it immediately, but she's not saying anything beyond what Republicans have been saying for years about health care, which is, oh, we should buy it across state lines if we can allow people to pool together in different ways and, you know, some measure of health savings accounts.
But the argument that I think some Republicans are making that they could have pushed much harder is that, look, you know, Democrats are secretly kind of happy that it's failing because they want to move to a single-payer nationalized health insurance plan. That's the argument that they should be making. Some are making that, but it's not being made in any coordinated coordinated way from the top down.
Well, then Democrats, I mean, that is part of their platform. I mean, you could argue that the, sure. you know, Sanders effect on the platform was that the push to allow states to create a public option. And when we spoke with Carol Shea Porter this week, I mean, she's pretty unabashedly liberal on this front. She says, you know, we need that kind of competition, which would be a sort of government.
It's not clear that that's where sort of the mass of the voters are. So no, it would be an opportunity for Republicans to, as you say, weaponize the issue.
All right. Election day is a week from Tuesday, everybody. I'm assuming that's going to be our almost unitary focus from now until then. But anything particular in the next week that you all are going to be paying attention to, Kevin?
Yeah, we're going to do a lot of focus on some of these key state Senate races we've talked about and just alluded to. There's about a half a dozen of them where Democrats feel they have a very good chance with some very good candidates. And it will certainly determine a lot of what happens at the legislature. If the state Senate flips to Democratic, that's very different for a Governor Colin Van Ostern or a Governor Chris Sununu.
And, you know, we haven't talked about the governor's race. That is something that I'm certainly going to be watching all week long, as will be Casey.
Yeah, I think that'll be my main focus, particularly just to see if the candidates get out on the trail a little bit more in this final stretch. They've done roundtables and press conferences, but we'll see how much they actually kind of go out and hit the pavement and try to get those final votes.
Dean? And they had a very lively debate on NH1 just earlier this week, I believe. It was very interesting to watch. Same here, trying to get a feel for what that last week is going to be like. You know, sometimes things close kind of late. Maybe that'll happen. So I'm just kind of looking to see what the big themes are going to be in this last week.
You know, we'll have the MUR debates are going to be on, and those are always the ones that get the greatest amount of audience and, you know, at least theoretically, get the people who are deciding particularly late. So that will be something that we will all be watching as well. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy the weekend. This is a New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.
Next week on The Exchange, we continue our Conversations with the Candidates series with two events. First, we sit down with U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte, a Republican running for re-election. And then later, we're joined by Anne McLean Custer, Democratic Congresswoman from the 2nd District. Send us your questions by email or Facebook and join us all next week for The Exchange. Every morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Made possible with support from New England College and Gough Wilson. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.